Welcome to Salcedo Paranormal. It is Thursday, March 16th, 2023. And today I am finishing my review of selected stories from Everything's Eventual, an anthology by Stephen King. As always, you can find all the links to the show, along with links to social media and other ways to contact me at the podcast page. And that is Salcedo Paranormal. .podbean.com. That's SALSIDO paranormal. .podbean.com. Always happy to hear from you all, whether you have comments or questions or topic suggestions or stories of paranormal experiences, whether they're your own or from others that you trust. Happy to either read those or have you join me on the show to talk about them. And this is, of course, the last show for a couple of days, and then I'll be back on Sunday morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning, with True Paranormal Stories on the Web. So, and this again is part two, the last part of a review of some of the stories from Stephen King's anthology called Everything's Eventual. And I reviewed two stories last week, and I have three that I'll review tonight, so just a reminder, next Thursday morning, Wednesday night, there will not be a live stream, but there will be an episode that is released that Thursday morning at some point, featuring friends of the show, Jen from Jennifer Hawkins' channel on YouTube, and of course Michael Strange from Trouble Minds Radio. So, looking forward to that conversation, and can't wait for you all to hear it once it is recorded and released. So, I think that takes care of everything for now. Thank you all for listening, whether you're here for the live streams, I see you all there, hello, or you listen to the podcast or YouTube feeds. I always appreciate everyone that listens, no matter how you listen. And especially those of you that are able to listen live, because I know that this is a bit late for some people, or early, however you want to look at it. So, like I said, I have three stories here to review. These are all, of course, Stephen King writes horror, paranormal, supernatural, horror, and suspense. A lot of the stories in this book are more suspense than they're horror, but not paranormal horror. In a way, that's why a lot of the stories, I'm not reviewing all the stories in this book, because there's just some that there wouldn't be a ton for me to talk about. So, just in case anyone is wondering, I think I mentioned that last week as well. And, yeah, so we'll get started on this next story here. It starts with an author, a successful horror writer. He's driving back from I believe it's a conference. But he's driving back from Boston to his home in Derry, Maine. Of course, Derry is where It and other stories have taken place of King's. So that town has some history. That and Castle Rock, of course. Mentions that, so basically in the story, as he's driving, he has to slow down because he comes to a street where there are cars parked along the sides of it. And that's because there is a yard sale going on. And so he's looking around the yard sale, and he instantly finds this painting. And it appears to be a sinister-looking man with sharply filed teeth driving his own car across Boston's Tobin Bridge. And the picture is called The Road Virus Heads North. And apparently the painting was created by a basically a genius painter, tortured genius painter, who actually burned his other pieces of artwork before passing away. And there is one note that was found before he passed, from him, explaining that he couldn't stand what was happening to him anymore. So, Now, this will sort of maybe come into play later with the painting itself. And so, of course, Richard Connell, who collects odd things, whatever he can, buys the painting, and he buys it from the woman holding the sale. Turns out she's not actually the owner of the house. She's doing this for a friend who does own the house. So as Connell keeps on heading back home, he stops at his aunt's house to show her the painting. And she doesn't like it. She gets a weird feeling from it. But even as he's getting ready to show it to her, he notices that the details on the painting have changed. It does not appear to be the same as it was the last time he looked at it. And he tries to rationalize and write it off as thinking he hadn't examined it closely enough. But as every time he looks at it, looks away and then looks at it again, the painting continues to change. And so this is starting to frighten him quite a bit, obviously. And so he throws the painting over the edge of a valley or something like that, down a hill and towards some water at a rest stop. So he thinks he's rid of it. Of course, he's not. Because once he gets home, he finds this painting is on his wall. It's hanging above his fireplace on his wall. Of course, you hear about this more commonly with things such as far as the vanishing and reappearing, Ouija boards and similar things. But there are, of course, if you look into it, you can find stories of haunted paintings and similar things. Usually, the details don't change, but also, I feel like I've heard of that. At least having apparitions coming from or appearing to change the picture. I have to look into that sometime. That might be a fun show to do. But and of course, when he looks at this picture that's now hanging in his home, it's showing a horrific, basically a crime scene, murder scene, where he can see the deceased, basically the body of the woman that he had bought the painting from. And so he figures out through various details each time the painting changes that the images are following his path. All the images are depicting the route that he has taken. And so in each one of these images keeps showing this figure getting closer and closer to where Connell lives. Also, there's this figure continues to look straight at the picture, like at the viewer of the picture, and just give off this ominous feeling. And so also, Connell becomes frightened for the safety of his aunt. And he calls her and leaves a message and asks her to call back. And meanwhile, he decides the only way to get rid of this painting is to set it on fire, to burn it down to ash. And so he does this, and he feels like he's probably taking care of it. He's still waiting to hear from his aunt. No, I'm sorry. He does hear from his aunt not long after that. And so he takes a shower and he passes out while he's in the shower and has a nightmare, of course, about the woman that he bought the painting from. Just kind of describing this creature, whatever it is. Not in great detail, but just hinting at that it's coming for him. And then, of course, Tanau remembers after he wakes up that the artist had burned all of his paintings except for this one. So there's this implied idea that somehow, whether it's from the artist or the process or both or some other force, there's some kind of power that is passing through the artist to these paintings. And of course, as he gets out of the shower, he hears the sound of a car pulling up his long driveway. And even though the painting is gone, the figure from the painting actually arrives at the house. And so it's basically that story ends with this figure about to kill him. It doesn't go into details of that part, but it's basically implied that it's going to kill him. Now, the thing in the story that I think is amazing writing is that he's worried for his aunt. But if you think about it, the aunt never owned the painting. It passed from one owner to another. And Hannibal paintings? Oh, hell no. Yeah, Mattel, I agree with that. And so I don't think his aunt would have ever been in trouble because she never owned the painting. I think it had to do with the chain of ownership. But then, of course, that raises a question. What happens? Where does this character in this painting go after the painting is gone? Did the artist somehow see this figure in his mind or even out in the open and then make a painting of it somehow? It's really hard to know. I mean, the rest of the details are left up to the reader, which I think is amazing. So, just goes back to the idea of where do ideas come from, and do they come from other beings in some cases? But then there's also the possibility of, did the artist somehow create this creature, this being? It's hard to know, again. But so that's where that story ends. Nice little happy ending there. Not really. But it is a horror story, after all. So that's that first one I wanted to cover. And here, next one, we have another story with the not so great ending here for the characters involved. So, but anyway, and this one, I believe actually two of these, the last one and this one, have been put into TV and or movie form in different ways. So, but and again, this is about another author. So that's kind of funny. I forgot about that. Starts off with this author who is a writer of nonfiction books based on the theme of haunted places. And he's become successful with it. His name is Mike Enslin. And he's done these books and he's visited these places, but he's never really had any weird kind of experience. Even though he writes all the stories down and about what he's heard from locals about the folklore and other experiences from people, and basically embellishes them to make them more terrifying than they may actually be. He doesn't really believe in the paranormal. Excuse me. So he arrives at this hotel. It's called the Dolphin Hotel in New York City. And he wants to spend the night in this infamous room 1408. That's the name of the story, is 1408. As part of his research for his next book, all about haunted hotels, haunted hotel rooms. And he's met by the hotel manager, Mr. Allen, who describes the past of the room and why it's not ever rented to anyone. Now, the funny thing about that is that is a thing that some hotels will do for rooms that are said to have a lot of activity. Of course, at this point now, I'm guessing there are some hotels that save those rooms for people that are interested in having a room with a lot of activity. But there's either way, that depends on the hotel and the stat and the management and whether or not they're interested in any of the paranormal. But in this case, Allen believes that 1408 has been responsible for 42 deaths over a span of 68 years. And through various causes, natural and otherwise. And Allen insists that there's something that lives inside that room that causes terrible things to happen to anyone that stays there. Also, something to note about this is that this hotel does something that other actual hotels do, which is they don't list this is known as the 14th floor, but it's actually the 13th floor. But because of that superstition, the idea that 13 is not a lucky number or a good number, it has been given the number of 14, the floor number of 14. So, let's see here. I lost track of where I was at. So, Allen is trying to persuade Enslin not to stay in this room, and has tried to refuse to allow Enslin to stay in this room. Of course, Enslin, being fairly successful, has hired a lawyer and has the legal right, technically, according to him, to stay in that room. So, even though Allen has tried to keep the room empty for all of his years as a manager at the hotel, which is about 20 years, almost 20 years. Mentions here the 13th floor. I already covered that. Also, the other thing about this room number itself is that if you add up the numbers, it can add up to 13. So, going back to that idea again. Enslin at first is not interested in having this discussion or hearing Allen's remarks and evidence that are meant to try to keep Enslin out, to convince him to just go away. But he's determined not to appear superstitious. And he, so he wants to follow through with the research. Even after all the things that Allen has told him, he is somewhat shaken a little bit, even though he doesn't want to admit it. So, of course, Allen pleads with Enslin to reconsider, but it's no good. So, let's see here. Going up to the story, he leads Enslin up to that floor, but does not walk past the out of the elevator to get onto the floor. Apparently, whatever the energy is coming from this room, it comes out of the room and to kind of lightly cover the whole hallway and everything. So Enslin has a voice recorder. He spends 70 minutes in this room, according to his basically everything that's been recorded in the story, including on the voice recorder. So he talks about his experiences into this tape recorder. But the odd thing about this recording is that the recording sometimes is messed up. and or fades out and in and out and everything as well. So, but almost right away, Enslin starts to feel like he is losing his mind, losing his train of thought. And he also thinks that he's starting to wonder if maybe it's all a trick and there's some kind of gas coming into the room through the vent system. He starts to have visual hallucinations. One of the things he notices is that there's this breakfast menu on the nightstand. I thought it was on the bed, but maybe it was on the nightstand. And when he looks at it, every time he blinks for a few times, it changes from the language on the menu changes from French to Russian to Italian, and then it changes into a woodcut, some kind of a drawing of a wolf basically eating a person. And also the pattern on the wallpaper appears to warp and change, and then the room's pictures also start to change as well. Things that are actually happening despite what everyone thinks happened after the whole experience is over, which is that he just lost his mind somehow. And Enslin feels like his feet are sinking into the carpet, almost like it's quicksand. And he hears a voice in the room's phone, just chanting terrifying phrases that don't really make any sense. So the room starts to melt and also basically collapse in on itself. And Enslin feels starts to sense this otherworldly presence that is dangerous, that's coming for him. So again, there's that idea of maybe like a portal somehow, where this room is somehow a gateway for whatever this is, to come in. And so he is trying to figure out how to escape, and and to clear his mind. So in order to clear his mind, he sets his own shirt on fire while wearing it. And it breaks the mind control that the room has on him long enough for him to try to escape. And he stumbles out into the hall, and another guest has to basically douse him with ice to put out the fire that is trying to consume him. And then when the other guest is watching or basically done with all this and looks at this other room, he's tempted to go inside the room. And again, it seems like this idea of this presence almost putting that suggestion in his mind. And before Enslin passes out, he warns the guest, other guests, not to. And so, let's see here. And he says that he tells this other guest that the place actually is haunted. So now he does believe, obviously. So after this whole thing that happened, Enslin stops writing altogether. He's basically had several physical and psychological problems that have come from his time in this room, which is only 70 minutes. But also his tape recorder, even though that the corners were melted. It still survived. Also, even though Alan mentioned before that there were no ghosts in 1408, because ghosts were people at one point, the whatever's in this room is basically not human. And so, and of course, Enslin at the time did not believe that, but now he does. Enslin sleeps with his lights on, and he has also removed all of his house's phones. And so he's basically been affected by this for good. And of course, his former agent has the recording of the whole thing, but doesn't know what to do with it, and ends up just storing it away, putting it away, and doesn't ever want to have anyone else listen to it because he thinks it's all either basically nonsense. So that's where that story ends. It really is quite the, I would almost say, psychedelic, the way it's described, or definitely just this collapsing of reality in on a room, the space of a room. And it's an amazing story, the build up to the actual time in the room, Alin trying to convince Enslin not to go in there, and their whole conversation is very well done. So yeah, that's that story. Definitely recommend this whole book. But I have one more to cover here, and that is Riding the Bullet. So let's see here. Gotta find the, here we go. Thank you all again for being here and listening to all these reviews. I really enjoy doing them, even though they are not easy to do, but it's still a lot of fun. So, getting to this last story here. So, this story starts with a young man named Alin Parker. He's a student at the University of Maine College. And he's trying to figure out basically what he wants to do with college and with life. But he gets a phone call from one of his neighbors in his old hometown. And she tells him that his mother has been taken to the hospital after having a stroke. So at this point, though, he doesn't actually have a functioning car. So he decides to hitchhike the 120 miles south to visit his mother. He's also, I mean, I'm guessing here, if I remember right, he's not really, it's not like he has a ton of cash either. So he ends up riding with an old man who just doesn't really like the feeling of riding with the guy. Alin doesn't, and so he tries to get out as soon as he can, and he starts walking. And so he's walking again, he comes up to a graveyard, and he's interested in it. He notices a headstone for a stranger named George Staub, and this tombstone reads, "Well begun, too soon done." And so the next car that comes down the road, as he's walking down the road again, is driven by someone who basically turns out to be the same guy, this George Staub. And he even appears to have the several stitches, they're basically black stitches, that have been sewn on, or basically used to keep his body together, because he had passed away, apparently, in not such a great fashion. And he also has a button on his shirt saying, "I rode the bullet at Thrill Village, Laconia." And so as the two are driving, Ellen is riding and George is driving and starting to get creeped out by these apparent stitches that are somehow holding this person together. George starts talking to Alan about this amusement park that he was too scared to ride on as a kid. And then also George tells Alan that before they reach the lights of town, Alan has to choose who goes on the death ride with him. And, of course, you don't really know for sure what that means, except that someone is going to pass. And the choices are either Alan himself or his mother. And there is no escape, no other options. And Alan tries to figure out what to do. And in the end, because this is Stephen King and, of course, these characters are, a lot of these stories are not, they're like people, but I think they're also in a way, sort of like exaggerated people in some case. But in the end, Alan chooses to save himself and tells him to take his mother. And so before they reach the town, George actually pushes Alan out of the car. And when Alan reappears, basically, somehow, he's back in at the graveyard. And he's wearing this button that George had been wearing. So eventually he gets to the hospital. But he finds that his mother is still alive. So when he gets there, he's talking with the nurses, and at first, he throws this button away, before he goes up to see her, and because he wants to write off the whole experience he just had, but even though you don't know where the button came from, then eventually before he leaves the hospital, his mother recovers, and Alan graduates from college and takes care of his mother for several years, but then eventually she has another stroke. And then one day after that, Alan realizes he's lost the button, he has this, I'm sorry, she didn't pass yet, she had another stroke at that point, and at this point he also loses the button, and he gets this phone call one day, and he knows what it's about, and it's basically his mother, who has passed. He finds the button underneath his mother's bed. And of course, he feels guilty about what he now is pretty sure actually happened. That's basically where the story ends. It's a lot more detailed and subtle than that, obviously. But it's an amazing story, and I definitely recommend it. And the whole book, like I said. Really, amazing stories in this book. In terms of horror stories, obviously. That's the one thing about horror stories. They don't always have happy endings. it's like horror movies in a way. A lot of those don't have happy endings either. But that's all I had for today. That's it for now. I'll be back on Sunday morning, Saturday night, with True Paranormal Stories from the Web on the next episode of Salcedo Paranormal. Take care, everyone.